This recording is produced from Open Reel Tapes, originally recorded for Vancouver Community College, Langara Campus, in 1974. This program forms part of the Langara College Real History Project, which restores and preserves British Columbia's oral history. This project is funded in part by the British Columbia 2000 Millennium Arts and Heritage Fund, in partnership with Vancouver Public Library and Langara College. Copyright for this product is held by Langara College. It may not be reproduced in whole or in part in any form without permission from the copyright holder. The title of this recording is Flood Control in the Fraser Valley. The interviewer is Morag McLaughlin. The interviewee is Darcy J. Baldwin. The audience consists of British Columbia history students at Vancouver Community College, Langara Campus, on a field trip to Cultus Lake.
Today, September 20th, 1974, we're very interested in what you have to tell us about whatever you've come prepared to talk about.
Well, in the first place, Mrs. McLaughlin, I don't want everyone to be concerned about all these bumps and stuff that I've bought here. There are two reasons for doing it. One is that when you asked me to speak about the 48th flood, I quite quickly said yes, I would. Then, after I had gotten down to consider what I would say to you, I realized that I hadn't been very specific with you, because in 48, in British Columbia, every river in the province went on the rampage. The Fraser and Columbia rivers are the ones which gave the greatest grief to the economy and of the province and to the people of the province. And either of those rivers, to discuss them in their entire length and the various areas which were affected, would take more time than we have here this evening. So I thought that perhaps I might narrow it down to the area which I am particularly familiar with, and it, I think, would be probably as good an example of what was happening elsewhere in the province, and particularly in the populated areas. So that I'm not going to be too general, and I also am not going to be too specific, because I understand from Mrs. McLaughlin that you'll be prepared to ask questions. So if there's anything that I say that you don't understand, or about which you would like to ask a question, this is the reason for all these documents. Well, as you get older, your memory is not as good. And in addition to that, it happens that by accident and otherwise, I have been mixed up in more than just the one flood. During the war, one of my duties was, when we went into Holland, to make a study of the diking systems of Holland. And of course there are three types of dikes. They have the huge, very expensive dike across the Zuider Zee, which is designed to do two things: A, to keep out the sea, and B, to allow them to pump out the sea water from behind the dike so that they can create more land. That leads to another kind of diking, which is called the boulder type, which has a two-way job, one to get the seawater out, and other to keep the fresh water in so that the soil will stay moist. And the third type of dike is a good example of it, is the huge dike around the island of Walcheren, which some of you may remember if you read the history. The Canadians had to breach, and in order to relieve the Dutch population of the German occupation, we sailed into the island after breaching the dikes. Now, that was one type of dike experience. Then we had the experience here in 48, and as a result of that, when the Red River Valley flooded in 1950 in Manitoba, I was asked by the Premier of the province to go back and give them a hand, so I got mixed up in that for several months. And then in 72, we had a very bad threat here again, and once again I was asked to take a hand in that. And then again last year we had another bad threat. So that these things sort of run together, and your memory might run over several of these things, and this is the reason for this great pile of bumpus, I say, so that if you ask a question, if I've been too general, I might be able to extract the answers from there from you without relying on my memory. The other thing is that we had experience here in 1894 with a flood. There are essential differences in each of these years of flood. Essential differences of people and the philosophies of the people who lived during the particular times. I'll get at that in a minute. So I thought that with that introduction, I might do this thing in three different parts. One, briefly discuss the 94 flood and the kind of effect on the kind of problems that existed. Briefly do a generalization, then discuss the 48 flood, and perhaps if we have time, indicate to you some of the action which has subsequently been taken to try and alleviate these problems. Now, I know you don't want a geography lesson, and I've told you that I thought about ought to limit this discussion to the Fraser River, and particularly this area. But I think it is essential to know something about the Fraser system and the vast expanse it drains in order to understand the kind of problem that exists at this lower end of it, the lower mainland, particularly having regard to the population and the monies available and the economies which are affected quite apart from the people. I think I could do no better than take a minute to, without relying on my memory and figures, the only kind of figures I remember now are not the figures in books, they're those of charming young ladies who won't take a look at me. And so at the risk of boring you, I'll read from the Fraser River Diking Board's interim report of 1949, which was designed to help both the provincial and the federal governments vote the monies to reconstitute the diking system. And in order to do this, people, of course, from Newfoundland, Ontario, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, the members from those areas had to be persuaded of the problem that was involved. And this is only part of the thing, and it describes, as better than any words I could use, the kind of system we have in the Fraser River. It says, "The Fraser River and its near neighbor, the Columbia River, are unique in certain aspects. Their watersheds consist of a tumult of great mountain peaks, subject in the winter to very heavy snowfalls and sub-zero temperatures, and to blistering heat in the summer. The spring season is short and erratic in its timing. The rain, when it comes, is almost tropical in quantity and continuity." Just coming back to this business of the spring being erratic, in 94, the flood occurred in July, early July. In 48, it occurred the last part of May. In 72, it was not really rising to its peak till early June. And as another example, the rainfall averages, so far as we have them on record, in June, the highest rainfall recorded for the month is something over 6 inches. The lowest, something over 1 inch. In 48, it was something just under 2 inches. This is only meaningful if you know when this rain is coming. If you get 6 inches over 30 days, that means just a little bit every day. But if you get 2 inches in 2 days, you've got a deluge. And when you marry that to the water which is coming down the rivers, plus the drainage from the interior lands within a small valley, such as this end of the Fraser Valley, you have a problem which is compounded. Now, there's a rather great difference between the Fraser and such big rivers as the St. Lawrence and the Missouri and the Mississippi, in that those three, in their lower reaches, consist of great stretches of flatland. And those in flood times act as sponges and absorb the water. Here we have in the lower Fraser Valley an area of some 900 square miles, much of which is not flatland, much of which is upland, and a river feeding through it, which is draining an area of some 90,000 square miles. Now, the state of Washington, for example, is smaller than the Fraser River Basin by some 22,000 or so square miles, which will give you an idea of the magnitude. Plus the fact that the Fraser River Basin drains an area of 700 miles in length. One of its tributaries alone, the Nachaco, is nearly 300 miles long. And in addition to that, you have such great rivers as the Thompson, the Quesnel, the Road River, Coquihalla, dozens more which I could name and which probably just bore you. Now, the facts are that when the Fraser reaches its peak, and when it reached its peak, for example, in 48, its flow is three times the normal flow of Niagara Falls. That's probably as good a comparison as I can give you. In other words, there's some 600,000 cubic feet per second of water rushing down the river. Now, no one can yet forecast when the peak will come, and no one can predict its magnitude. We have means of measuring snow, we have means of measuring waterfall, we have weather forecasts, and so on. But when you consider the vast distance through which these water courses flow, different climates, different times of arrival of spring, different soil contexts of the country through which it flows, you can put them on the best computer in the world, and without knowing what can happen at a certain time, not get the answers. And no one knows what can happen at a certain time. In other words, any year, any spring, is a potential flood year. And will be in my time. I think it will be in your time. And it may be in your children's time, because man has not yet found a way to get the answer to these kind of disasters. And you just have to think of other kinds of natural performances, fire, slides, Frank Slide right in our border with Alberta, the slide at Spencer's Bridge, the slide up here at Hope on the Hope-Princeton Highway, drought. You know what happened in the central part of the United States this year in respect to drought, millions and millions of dollars worth of damage it has done. Grasshopper plagues in the prairies, hurricanes, earthquakes, diseases, all these sort of things. We have a long way to go to get the clear answers to some of these natural performances of nature. An example is that we know that the 48 flood was termed a national disaster. But in 1935, there was an ice storm in the Chilliwack Valley, which took out all telephone poles, all hydro poles, froze up all water systems, cut off the railways again. Some areas of the valley were without power for as long as 8 weeks. Some areas were without telephone for as long as 3 months. This is a different kind of a disaster. It wasn't a national disaster, but it was as a result of the kind of country we live in. And I don't think that anyone can forecast, weather-wise or otherwise, what we're likely to do. Now, what nature is likely to do. Now, there are certain guideposts, and there are certain physical things we can do by building dikes, by doing certain drainage things, by installing pumps in certain areas. We can nudge the river a little bit here and nudge it a little bit there, lessen its effect a little bit here and a little bit there. But there is a basic problem behind all this. Some people will say, well, why don't we build dams? Well, when you build a dam, you flood hundreds of miles of land behind that dam if it's to be of any size. You all know, for example, of the stink that the province of Alberta raised as a result of the Peace River Dam being built and for hydro purposes. We created a power source and a water source for ourselves and drained a water supply out of the province of Alberta, which is still a very fractious problem. This is just a typical example. No matter what you do, you affect fisheries, you affect agriculture, you affect industry, you affect roads, railroads, all sorts of things when you go to build these man-built things. And this is all part of the problem. And if we have the time, I'll discuss some of these things with you in a minute. Now, in the 94 flood, two things were important: the kind of people and the kind of communications. Chilliwack, as you all probably know, is an Indian word, and its literal meaning is land of many waters. This was all really delta land. I'm talking now of the lowland. And in 94, when the flood came in July that year, no one to speak of lived in the uplands, that is, on the higher lands. Everybody lived on the lowland, and there was a good reason for this, because all transportation was by water. As late as 1928, bulk freight, for example, came up from New Westminster to Chilliwack to a place called Minto Landing. Things like flour, sugar, grain came up by paddle boat and were offloaded at Minto Landing and taken to the various storehouses. So that this was important. In other words, the people were water conscious, and much of the good land on the lowlands had to be drained as well because of the swampy type of land it was. They were also people who knew self-help. There was no such thing as government assistance. There was no neighborly help, yes, but help in the wider sense, such as we understand it today, that wasn't available. Also, Sumas Lake was still in existence, and I think Bob has distributed some maps which show you that. And if we have time later, I will give you let you look at a map here, which is an old railway belt map, which shows where the country where you came through today on a beautiful highway was all lake. It was famous for its goose shooting, its duck shooting, its grouse shooting. People from the state of Washington used to picnic on it, and it was famous most of all for its mosquitoes. And that lake was drained in the 20s, and I think you know something of that, and I'm not going to talk about it, and then opened for settlement. Well, the people that came in there to settle it were people who had come in to a completely new piece of land. Largely it was corporations that were settling in there. People grew tobacco there. You probably passed Buckerfield's big farm coming in there today. In other words, these people came in to settle a new piece of land which had been drained. They were not dike conscious. They were not water conscious. The dikes that had been built around them were put under the control of what was known as a diking commissioner. And these people, of course, were trying to break new land, to grow something, to make a living on it. And taxes were something they weren't about to pay. And one thing they were not about to pay were dike taxes. The result is that the poor diking commissioner had all these miles of dikes to maintain and keep in order, but could raise no tax money to do it. Therefore, he couldn't get it done. And over the years, these dikes became heavily overgrown. You've heard of the jungle growth of western British Columbia. These dikes became overgrown, were not properly maintained through no fault of his, through ignorance on the part of the people who paid taxes, and by a very curious matter of administrative boundaries, part of these new dikes came into the Chilliwack municipality area. Now, another factor that was important in 94 was that there was no instant press. Nobody was shoving a mic in front of you to say what was going to happen tomorrow, and there was no such a thing as TV, and there was no daily press up here. There was a weekly press, and by accident it got flooded out, so it wasn't publishing. And the nearest newspaper was the New Westminster Columbian, which would get here if the boat came in. And if the boat didn't come in, then there was no news, and you didn't bother about the news until the boat came in. So this psychologically was a very important thing, because people weren't waiting around for someone else to tell them what to do. They got out and helped themselves. Now, following the 94 flood,